I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey everybody, Daniel here to just let everybody know that the Cannonball is a proud member of Agora Podcast Network. And this month, Agora Podcasts are brought to you in part by the folks over at Wondery, another podcast network, who would invite you to check out American Innovations, a new podcast of theirs. And we actually have a preview episode up in our feed, so if you haven't listened to that yet, go check it out. And while you're also checking out other podcasts, please go to agorapodcastnetwork.com. Find them on Facebook, find them on Twitter, and check out all of our wonderful sister shows out there. And without any further ado, here we go with rounding up Don Quixote.
Hello, and welcome to The Cannonball, a podcast attempt to read all of the books in Harold Bloom's list of the Western canon. This is Claude Myron Guzer, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Daniel Doherty. Daniel, how are you doing?
Good evening, Claude. I'm doing well. I'm feeling pumped. We were talking in the chat just about how amped we are to talk about book two of Don Quixote. Because, folks, if you thought book one was a meta commentary upon any and all things, and a kind of just funhouse mirror literary romp. Friends, Cervantes was just getting started, so this is gonna be fun. This is cool, and it's kind of, I don't know, it's a little exciting, kind of wrapping up the all of our Don Quixote material. You know, we've been at it for a few months now.
Yeah, and it's I'm having this horrible time because the more I get into book two, the more I just want to do a podcast about book two and Don Quixote. it really is so extraordinarily rich.
I mean, consider that, friends out there in Radioland, consider that a call to action. We here at the Cannonball are abdicating any attempt at doing a podcast devoted solely to Don Quixote, but that does not mean that you all should not pick up the baton. So any enterprising readers out there, go for it.
No, speak for yourself. Any enterprising readers, talk to me. Okay. What happened was, I think we talked about this last time, that, or maybe even just the first time we did this, mm-hmm. was that I've been reading this book since I was about 17 years old, and now I'm an old man. And the thing that first drew me to it was that it was, you know, my interpretation of it, which was inaccurate, which we'll talk about in a little bit, was that it was kind of like this light, silly romp, mm-hmm. and kind of a satire of the character of Don Quixote, or kind of a mockery of him. And over the years, the more I read it, the more serious it became. And this time around, using sort of Echeverria's guide, it's extraordinarily illuminating, and there is so much more richness and depth to the whole. Mm-hmm. I really, really saw that in book one, but book two goes bananas.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, the whole thing is so bizarre. If you break down the structure, if you break down, the thematic things that he's really, really playing with. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. And I do want to say, I'm not trying to basically do a Cliff Notes version of Echevarria. Mm-hmm. If any readers are really interested in taking a deep dive into Don Quixote, I would say start with Echevarria. Mm-hmm. There are things that I find problematic. There are things I think in there that are somewhat too pat. There are things that I just flat out disagree with. But he's a signpost. I mean, he has his own illuminations, and he's also a signpost for several hundred years of commentary on Don Quixote. So I kept wondering, would it be possible to do a kind of annotation of Don Quixote like there are annotations of Dante? Because part one, I think, could deserve it. But part two really is so rich that I think it needs it to a degree.
Yeah.
But I was – the more I got into it, the more astounded I was. It was sort of like – wow.
Yeah, and
so wild.
And I guess I would say from like a I guess from the hermeneutic I bring to a lot of this stuff, like I can't help but find myself thinking about various historical contexts for all the works that we're reading. And you know, it's a fool's game to everything. First of all, it's a mug's game to everything you're going to understand the past. You're not. Just accept that. that's the first rule of studying history. You'll never understand it.
Yeah.
You know, adding on to that, like, you know, I like reading Don Quixote, I always felt like there was, I mean, there's so much going on with it. And it's so embedded in its that point in time and this place and these processes that Miguel de Cervantes observed around him that, you know, I found myself thinking as I was reading, like, unless I had like a doctorate in early modern Iberian history, I would never be able to even scratch the surface of what this man is really talking about. So, but I say that to mean like the idea of reading Don Quixote with a kind of, this kind of expansive, critical, what's the word I'm looking for? Not guide necessarily, but this expansive, critical companion that Echevarria has composed. That's really I would also recommend that. Just from even from my standpoint, I'm not necessarily like, you know, I'm not nearly as well versed in theory as Claude is, as anyone who listens to the show will likely know.
I think that's a damning compliment.
but that is to say that, like, with Don Quixote especially, I mean, all the works that we read have sort of engendered that feeling in me. And I don't know if it's just because I have this particular, like, it really eats at me that I don't understand the Spanish Empire, like, even less than I understand other things.
Well, you know, I think at that point, I don't think the Spanish Empire understood the Spanish Empire.
Not at all.
Some of the moves they made.
That ties into a certain interpretation I have of the character of Don Quixote, which I guess I'll save for our kind of our wider shot at the after we sort of talk about what happens.
Okay, all right. So what we figured was that we could sort of begin this in the same mode that we did the last one. We're going to start off. I'm going to do basically a synopsis of the plot and walk through the major beats of the book. And then I've got a couple of different sort of theoretical or thematic concerns that I want to take a close look at. Mm-hmm. And you'll hop in with some of the history as we keep moving along. And that's how we're going to get through this rough beat.
Yeah, that sounds good, man. I really hope that I do have something to say, because I sometimes feel like, especially Don Quixote, like I've been sitting here like learning more and more as I listen to you like talk about it, man. So I'm hoping I'm gonna pull my weight this time.
Yeah. I think you got this, man. All right. So I did. The significant event that happened between book one and book two was the composition of a fake second book of Don Quixote.
Mm-hmm. The unauthorized sequel, as we might call it today.
Yeah. It was an unauthorized sequel. Cervantes discovered it while he was writing the second book of Don Quixote. So late, I guess about two-thirds of the way through the second book of Don Quixote, Don Quixote discovers that the second book has been written.
Mm-hmm.
And so he makes certain choices in order to negate the second book. So, like, we'll talk about it in a second, but, you know, late in the game, he's going to Saragossa to go to the jousting tournaments, and then finds out that the fake Don Quixote in the fake second book went to the jousting tournaments at Saragossa. And he's like, well, in order to prove it wrong, I have to go to Barcelona.
Mm-hmm.
So he just shifts course. But anyway, so that's the framework that's the sort of, I guess, historical event that's lurking back there.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that happened was book one became extraordinarily popular. It didn't necessarily make Cervantes a lot of money. He had a lot of fame,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't necessarily have riches to go along with it.
Like if you have a viral YouTube video.
Yeah, or a podcast.
or an extremely popular podcast with millions of listeners like we do.
We're not extremely popular.
Hey, they don't know that. I want our audience to feel like they're a part of something really big. No, yeah. But you're right, though. They're the elite who know, man. Yeah. Our listeners are people of discernment and taste.
Yeah, it's caviar to the general.
That's right.
But anyway, to get back, so he set out to write a second book, but the weird thing about the second book is from the very beginning, the characters in the second book are made aware that they're characters in the first book.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the game he's playing with the whole structure, is this sort of meta-literary game. I'll talk about why that's important in a little bit. All right, so I'm skipping over the introduction, which is very, very funny, and includes a couple of just bizarre anecdotes that are kind of covert jabs at the fake book of Don Quixote.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just weird. I urge everyone to read it just for the dog blowing story. There's some weird story that Cervantes is telling about this guy who was a madman in a local town who found a way to stick a straw up a dog's butt and blow into it to inflate the dog and then kick it around. And the crux of the story is he's answering a criticism of the author of the second fake book, who says that Cervantes is a terrible writer and didn't do anything really worthwhile. And Cervantes answers back, so consider this anecdote and think to yourself, well, do you know how to blow up a dog? So he's putting Don Quixote in this very strange place. But anyway, so book two opens up very... Cervantes had to be careful about this. You could not be openly critical of the crown in any way.
Yeah.
And I really don't know what exactly his feelings about certain things were, but this is an extraordinarily ironic and extremely ambivalent work.
Yeah.
Particularly as regards the official power structure. But it opens up with Don Quixote contemplating the current state of the Spanish military. There's this call for all kinds of solutions to what I suppose we would call the problem of the Moriscos. The Jews had been kicked out of Spain in 1492,
mm-hmm.
and the Moriscos, a lot of them were still sort of kind of hanging around. These were Moorish converts to Catholicism, and there was this kind of general fear that they would be a kind of fifth column.
Right. Yeah.
That would allow the Turkish army to invade.
Right, exactly. This is because, yeah, you know, at this time there was kind of the... there was just sort of general panic about the Turks because this, you know, this was supposed to be the time, like, you know, the high watermark of Ottoman Turkish expansion, you know, under Suleiman the Magnificent, you know. But yeah, and so the Spanish state was part of a Mediterranean empire as well as the Iberian Peninsula and the New World at this point, because they still held like Sicily and southern Italy.
Right.
So that they were kind of directly in the crosshairs, and, you know, looking out across the Strait of Gibraltar to the, you know, the Barbary, what we, you know, would know as, I guess, the Barbary Coast or North Africa. you know, it's kind of like almost a pincer movement there. And, you know, throw into that the long, long, long tradition of valorizing the struggle against Muslims and how vile they are in Iranian culture. And yeah, I mean, it's just rife for all kinds of truly just really awful paranoia and repression.
So what is Don Quixote's solution? Well, revive chivalry. So, and there's something to that. We'll get to that in a little bit. But so he comes up with this plan. He's talking to the barber and the priest from the first book, and he comes up with this plan basically to send this long, detailed list to the king. Here's what you need to do to revive chivalry. And they worry that he's going mad again, but he tells them very clearly, I know who I am. I'm sane. I'm not a lunatic. Sancho shows up with news of the first book. This local student, Sansón Carrasco, has read the first book of Don Quixote and has been telling everybody about the first book of Don Quixote. And so Don Quixote is famous without even really knowing it.
Yeah.
So Sansón Carrasco shows up to basically give them all the details. And Sancho cleans up the errors of the first book. There were a couple of errors in the first book. Does Sancho's donkey get stolen by Gines de Pasamonte or does it not? What is Sancho's wife's name? There are a couple of other details that Cervantes kind of shifts or forgets about or does what have you. And so Sancho says, well, you know, everybody seems to be pointing out this, but really the donkey was taken from me in this way. And then I got it back at this point. I mean, what's the problem?
which is a brilliant way to do your kind of retroactive continuity fixes. By just having like Luke pointing out like, oh yeah, well, you know, someone else wrote the book. It wasn't written by us. So they got some details wrong.
but anyway, it's this self-consciousness or self-awareness that they've already been written about. So Sansón Carrasco tells them the best thing to do to go really prove chivalry in this horrible debased time is to go to the Festival of St. George in Saragossa. And Sancho goes home to talk to his wife. She doesn't want him to go, but he wants to go anyway because he's still being promised this insula, this island that he doesn't even know what it is. All right, so Don Quixote and Sancho sneak out at night. And they ride for a day, and then in the dark, or close to daybreak, but still in the dark, they make it to Toboso, because Don Quixote wants to pay obeisance to his lady Dulcinea before he leaves. They get to Toboso, and Sancho has this problem, because Sancho in the first book had told Don Quixote that he took the note to Dulcinea, so technically Sancho is the only one who knows who Dulcinea is and what she looks like. He's also apparently supposed to be very familiar with the town of Toboso. Now, Sancho is neither of those things. So he has to improvise and come up with some kind of scheme. So he keeps Don Quixote in the dark up to a degree. And then as day breaks, he sees these peasant women riding donkeys, and they're kind of rough and burly, and Sancho just figures, well, Don Quixote keeps seeing the wrong thing as the wrong thing all the time anyway, so I'll just say one of these peasant ladies is Dulcinea, and he'll never know the difference because he's just going to mistake it for a princess anyway.
Right.
Something strange happens because Don Quixote does not go along with it, and he doesn't see them transformed. He sees them as peasant women. And part of what you get is, well, Don Quixote says they must be enchanted. This must be an enchantment by one of the enchanters who's always following me around. So he mistakes reality for enchantment.
Yeah.
All right. So instead of seeing an inn and thinking it's a castle, he sees this peasant woman and thinks she must be a princess, but she's been enchanted to make me see her as this.
Yeah.
So it's this weird convoluted commentary on his earlier delusions. All right. So they head back out and they hit the road, and that's when they run into a wagon with an assembly of death. They run into a bunch of actors who are going from town to town to perform these kinds of, I guess, morality plays.
Yeah. That's the I believe it would have been in the tradition of what's called the mystery play, which it was a form of theater in the most prominent in the Middle Ages and continuing on into the early modern. That it emphasized, well, morality plays, like you said. Like it they were very didactic, heavy-handed, just glaringly allegorical plays about how to be a good peasant and how to love the church with all your life, you know, kind of stuff.
So one of these characters, they haven't changed costumes because the towns are so far apart that by the time they get to the next one, they got to just jump up on stage.
Yeah.
So they first meet a devil, and then they meet Death, like this guy dressed up as Death. And so Sancho is terrified, but Don Quixote sees them as actors. He doesn't see them as the characters.
Right.
This is part of this long game that Cervantes is playing with disenchantment. I'll talk about that in a little bit. So they still get in a fight with the actors over something stupid, but eventually Don Quixote gets his horse back. One of the actors steals Sancho's donkey, and they get it back. So anyway. That's when they ride into the forest, and late at night they meet this other knight and this other squire who are professing the same kind of chivalry as Don Quixote is.
Yeah.
This is, we find out, is the Knight of the Mirrors. It's this this knight who has tiny little sparkling, shimmering sort of half moons all over his coat. Or all over his armor. And the Knight of the Mirrors says something about having defeated Don Quixote in battle. Mm-hmm. And Don Quixote says, "That's impossible, I'm right here." And then the Knight of the Mirrors says, "Well, I need to defeat you because you claim that Dulcinea is the most beautiful and my girl is the most beautiful." And so they get into the chivalric argument and set up for a joust. In the morning, they joust. Don Quixote accidentally wins. Keep that in the back pocket because this is something that we can pay attention to structurally. There are a lot of mirrors in Don Quixote.
Right.
Well, you have the Knight of the Mirrors, but you also have echoes or mirror reflections of things that happened in the first book.
Right.
And in a weird way, Don Quixote accidentally winning this contest is a parallel to accidentally winning against the Basque.
Right, right.
It's set up in the same way and at about the same point in the book. So the Knight of the Mirrors falls over and they take his helmet off and it's Sansón Carrasco, the guy who told him to set off in the first place.
Right.
But Don Quixote decides it can't possibly be Sansón Carrasco. It's some other knight that all of these evil enchanters have made look like Sansón Carrasco. Right. So Sansón and his squire, who is this dude that Sancho knows from the neighborhood, are both beaten up and limp off to find an inn where they can heal their wounds. And Don Quixote figures, well, I just won a fantastic contest. I'm going to keep going on the road.
Yeah.
So he and Sancho keep heading to Zaragoza. They meet a gentleman in green, Don Diego de Miranda. He gives Don Quixote gives advice to Don Diego about what to do about his son. His son wants to study the arts, but he doesn't know if his son should do that. His son wants to be a poet and wants to go into the literary profession. And Don Quixote offers him sage advice about, you know, the power of poetry and how influential and important it is, and how his son should basically follow his own path. In the middle of this, Don Quixote tries to fight a lion.
Right.
A guy shows up with two lions that he's transporting to the king, to court.
Yeah.
They're a gift from some other courtier. And this is one of those weird moments in Don Quixote that is both extraordinarily realistic and extraordinarily fantastical. Like, yeah. How often does this happen, and yet you see this happen?
I mean that's the kind of thing, like you know, the like this exchanging of diplomatic gifts, including sort of remarkable creatures, is extremely longstanding. You know, I mean, this goes all the way back to like. What was it? The Caliph of Baghdad gifted Charlemagne an elephant one time. You know, I mean, this kind of stuff actually does happen. But yeah, you sort of think about like, man, what if I was just some guy on the road and I see this elephant walking down in, you know, in the middle of France? Like, yeah, it's got to be pretty nuts.
I used to teach conversational English at a place that was 2 blocks away from Rockefeller Center. Mm-hmm. And I was walking to work once October morning, and there were a bunch of camels just hanging out in front of the office. I was like, what in the world? They were setting up the Christmas pageant, but like, it's the rehearsal.
Yeah, yeah.
So they got to keep dragging the animals in for this.
Yeah, you know, the camels are on their smoke break outside, you know, got it. But yeah.
Yeah. So it's one of those things that's fantastical, but also extraordinarily normal. Yeah. So anyway, Don Quixote convinces the guy to open the cage so that Don Quixote can face down the lions. Everyone else runs away. The lion comes out, is sleepy and full of food, so he just turns his butt to Don Quixote and walks back in the cage. So Don Quixote considers this a win. Sancho, changes his name from the Knight of the Sad Face or the Knight of the Sorrowful Face to the Knight of the Lions. And Don Quixote follows Don Diego back to his house, where they hang out and, you know, stay for a day or so. And he basically gives Don Diego's son some sage advice on how to be a writer, and they enter into some literary criticism. And they can't tell if Don Quixote is sane or insane. And that becomes kind of a running thing all throughout. Everyone who talks to him says, wow, if you don't get him started on the chivalric stuff, he seems like the smartest, wisest man in the world.
Yeah.
Get him started on chivalry. He goes off the deep end. All right. So they leave Don Diego's, and they meet a shepherd who tells the story of Basilio and Camacho. Basilio is a poor guy with lots of abilities who has fallen in love with this woman, Quiteria, or a girl, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And Camacho is this rich man who's just inherited all his wealth, who's also in love with Quiteria. And he has proposed to her, and she apparently has said yes, she will marry him. It's a mirror of the Cardenio story.
Yeah.
The rich suitor versus the poor suitor, the one who loves, the one who doesn't, you know, who has the ability and the talent, who doesn't. But anyway, Don Quixote and Sancho enter this area that's sort of arranged like this giant theater. It's got tons of food, and Sancho, you know, hits the soup pots, and they watch this pageant occur. It's sort of like a mask. It's a mask that illustrates basically Basilio's side.
Yeah. And so for some of our for some of our listeners, Claude, could you explain what a mask is? Because I have to confess, I was well into college before I ever actually understood what the heck a mask was.
It's this weird genre where you would basically get a very good playwright to compose a court entertainment for you that you would participate in, that you would act in.
Yeah, so it was almost like kind of like a play or an opera, but that took place around the party that you had all your courtiers at.
Exactly. Yeah. Sometimes you were in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes you were not. You know, Milton wrote a couple of these, or he wrote a famous one, Comus, for a friend of his daughter. Yeah. So, you know, it's if I remember correctly. Okay, don't quote me on that. We're doing Milton next time. Right. I'll have my facts straight by then. But he wrote a famous mask called Comus, which I believe was for his friend's daughter. And it was sort of like a courtly puritanical entertainment for her. Anyway, so it's this large theatrical production. And at the end of it, Basilio, the sort of jilted suitor, comes in and contests Camacho's love. He says, I'm not as rich as you, but I'm a much more talented guy. At this, he pulls a sword and stabs himself and falls over, bleeding to death. He calls for a priest, but says he won't take final rites until Quiteria marries him.
Yeah.
And so the plan is it's a con. But the plan is to get her to say yes to him, and then he'll take final rites and die. And he's playing, Echeverria makes this point. He's basically blackmailing the whole party, because mm-hmm. if they let him die without taking funnel rites, then basically he's going straight to hell.
Right.
Because he's a suicide.
Right.
But if he takes funnel rites, the chance is that he'll get into purgatory. So they're either going to condemn him or, you know, let him pass on to someplace not so bad or not as bad. Kitaryo agrees. And that's when Basilio jumps up and says, aha, it was a trick. He had a tube loaded with blood that he stuck into his armpit, and he basically conned her into marrying him. But she wanted to marry him anyway and was only marrying Camacho for the money.
Yeah.
So, which is made clear. So Camacho says, yeah, that's cool. Fine. You guys go ahead. And Basilio and Kitaryo go off to his place, and Don Quixote and Sancho and Basilio's followers go with them. So it's there at that party. It's like a party after the party. They meet the cousin of Basilio, who's a student, who tells them about the Cave of Montesinos. So this is an actual cave in Spain. And it's named after this character from this round of Spanish legends about, or it's Spanish poems about characters from French romance, if I've got that right. So Don Quixote says, you know, there's supposed to be all kinds of splendors in the cave. I want to go in and explore it. So they get to the edge of the cave and all these bats and ravens fly out. So that's this creepy portent. They lower him down into the cave with a rope. They lower it all the way to the bottom. They wait a while. Sancho and the cousin are they. They wait a while and eventually they pull him up and they find that Don Quixote is asleep. So they wake him up and he tells them that he had this magnificent vision down there. He was down there for a much longer period of time, at least several days. And he says he was in this kind of blissful afterlife. Now, what he describes down there is falling asleep and then waking up. Mm-hmm. So if you want to consider this his dream, he had a dream that he fell asleep and woke up. So it's like this weird dream within a dream. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot about this book that gets very Inception-esque.
Right.
But he falls asleep and then wakes up in his dream. And while he's down there, he meets all of these characters out of chivalric legend. He meets Montesinos. And then he also meets Durandarte, who was this chivalric knight who, as he was dying, cut out his heart to send to his beloved, and he's frozen in time.
Yeah.
This is this kind of afterlife where all of these chivalric characters have been frozen in time, but these weird, strange things start to happen. Montesinos holds up the heart of Durandarte, and it's preserved in salt. So it's sort of like, on the one hand, you've got, you know, here's my grand romantic gesture, send her my bleeding heart.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you've got this shriveled piece of beef jerky
that's
sort of sitting in his hand.
Yeah.
And that's how they describe it. So he goes to see the tomb of Durandarte, and the tomb of Durandarte is a mausoleum, but instead of a statue on top of the coffin, like, all right, have you ever seen, you know, noble tombs in Europe or fancy tombs in Europe where they have a kind of statue of the person on the top of the tomb?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, that's so, I actually recall I saw Dante's tomb, which has just that. So like,
yeah.
I got a nice little sculpture of the man himself, you know, looking very stern and serious.
Did he ever look otherwise?
I mean, one would assume like, not. I mean,
for the writer of the Commedia, he's very serious.
Right.
Anyway, sorry, it's stupid. But on top of the tomb is Durandarte, his body. So it's sort of like instead of the monument being the monument is him himself. And he starts speaking to Don Quixote and gives, you know, this kind of lament. And then Don Quixote sees several other characters from chivalry who are both timeless and also seem to have aged.
Yeah.
So it's a strange moment. And then he sees the enchanted Dulcinea who hits him up for money. So it's the peasant girl. It's Dulcinea as the peasant girl, and she has been enchanted, and this is sort of like his imaginative confirmation of Sancho's con. And he only has a certain amount of money, but gives her what he has, which isn't as much as she wanted, and then she hops away. So he gets up, and Sancho is sort of arguing with him and says, you know, I really think you got to rethink this, because you got to be crazy to believe this is real. And Don Quixote says, I know you have my best interest at heart, but trust me on this.
Yeah.
All right. So they get back out and they keep going, and they go to an inn, and Don Quixote does not mistake it for a castle. That's where they meet Master Pedro, who is this traveling puppeteer who also has a monkey who will sit on his shoulder and tell him the future. Now, the monkey isn't actually doing anything. We find out that the puppeteer is none other than Ginés de Pasamonte, the thief and guy headed for the galleys that Don Quixote freed in the first book. He comes back disguised. And he's got this trick monkey. What he does is goes into town way ahead of time, gets a bunch of information about everyone and everything, and then he'll take money to spit back out present information about the town.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Because he pretends the monkey is telling him stuff. But he knows Don Quixote, so he can talk all about Don Quixote. So anyway, he has this puppet show, which is a reenactment of a chivalric quest. The guy, Ginés de Pasamonte, is in disguise as Maestro Pedro, is pulling the strings of the puppets and making the puppets work. And he's got this kid who's basically doing all the dialogue and doing all the plot. And the kid keeps going off book and adding and improvising and doing all this other stuff. And so both Don Quixote and Master Pedro keep telling him, no, stick to the script, please. Stick to the script, please. Don Quixote, at a certain point, after pointing out all the inaccuracies, is so taken by the story in the puppet that he attacks the puppets, believing they're actual Moors out to get the two characters who are fleeing them. So you've got this story within the story that is then interrupted by Don Quixote. But all of this, again, is this reflection of, I guess, what the Spanish would have considered the problem of the Moriscos.
Right, right.
All right, so anyway, he pays off Maestro Pedro. And then the next day, he and Sancho are riding out again. They get in a boat and let it go. Don Quixote thinks the boat is going to take them to Parnassus or some kind of other mystical place. Sancho, I can't remember the place he claims, but he thinks it's going to take them into further magical adventures. And Sancho is very, very concerned about it. And they hear this horrible noise. This is a parallel to the fulling mill. Like the section in book one where they hear the horrible noise in the forest, and Don Quixote wants to valiantly stand up for it. And what it is a watermill that they're heading straight towards. So Don Quixote refuses to acknowledge the danger. A bunch of millers covered in flour who look like ghosts basically save them. By pushing the boat out of the way, and they swim to shore, they reclaim their mounts, and then keep going. All right. One of the funny things, and this will come up again later, Don Quixote is using all kinds of Ptolemaic cosmological stuff to guide the boat.
Yeah.
And by that point, Ptolemy had been completely disregarded. So even science is like way off.
Even in the most, you know, we might consider sort of the Spanish state to be among the most sort of hidebound and backward in that sense. But even among Right. Yeah. Even among the, you know, the church dominated, Spanish society, it was right. Ptolemaic astronomy was, I mean, yeah, definitely yesterday's news.
So this is where things really sort of take a turn in the novel. They're walking through the woods through the woods, and that's when they meet the Duke and Duchess. They're hunting with hawks. All right. So Echevarria makes this point, and I think it's something worth pointing out. And I want to pause here to talk about the Duke and Duchess very briefly.
Yeah.
The Duke and Duchess are pretty clearly they're emblematic of a corrupt, useless aristocracy that is good for nothing.
Right. yes.
They are, you know, the 1% as reflected in the Kardashians or Paris Hilton or what have you. They are useless.
Well, and they're kind of like a they're kind of like this ultimate refutation of the very idea of chivalry.
Yes.
I mean, because the whole point of the chivalric order was that through this kind of hierarchy of nobility, then that the higher up you are, the more nobility you would embody. And of course, the Duke and Duchess are, you know, they're just the lowest of the low, just reptiles.
Yeah, it's very easy to hate them for a lot of reasons. Now, one of the things that I find amazing is that Cervantes never quite tips his hand. There's a lot of ambivalence, and you kind of have to look for it, but he never quite comes out and talks about how awful and useless they are. The narrative never shifts tone, but the details are all there. Let's talk about those details. First, they're hunting with hawks. Okay, so if you're hunting on horseback, or hunting without horses or doing what have you, you're basically subsistence hunting. You're hunting for food, or you're hunting to use it in some capacity, but hunting for, and there's an actual work that goes along with it.
Yeah.
Right. It's sort of like how sports in a way is a reflection of warfare. So hunting is kind of like this reflection of warfare.
Right.
But the Duke and Duchess are hunting with hawks, which basically means you're standing in a field, putting a bird on your arm, then throwing it up in the air, and then waiting a little bit for it to come back with a rabbit.
Yeah.
So if football, let's say, is a reflection of warfare, then what the Duke and Duchess are doing is playing John Madden.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's already sort of debased if you know where to look for it.
Yeah.
Now, a couple of other things come out in the episode of the Duke and the Duchess. All right, so they've already read book one of Don Quixote, and they treat Don Quixote as if he is a knight errant. So it validates some of his ideas. But they know, and they're just making fun of him the whole time. The thing is, he is much more cosmopolitan than they are, and in fact behaves much more graciously than they do. So his false chivalry is actually more chivalric than their very real aristocracy.
Yeah.
It's exactly what you were saying. Now, if you pay close attention, you figure out that they have basically bankrupted themselves, and they just keep borrowing more and more money from this rich farmer who lives on their land, and he's happy to loan it to him, presumably on lots of interest.
Yeah.
But they are making nothing, they're doing nothing, and they're not even adequately overseeing their own property. The guy who's really in charge of everything, if you read between the lines and know where to look, is the butler.
So he's
the one who sets all the entertainments in order. He's the one who's keeping everything in line. He's the one who's basically writing everything, because they have I lost count of how many processions occur in the Duke and Duchess episode. I think it's about three.
Yeah.
Where they keep having these elaborate, fantastic displays just to mess with Don Quixote. And it's like, what do you do with yourselves? But anyway, so they're more or less bankrupt. They behave like jerks, And they're not even just in their judgments and decisions. So, and we'll talk about that in a second. But it's really, really, really.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kyler Tsinis.
Kayla Itzinis.
I'm Kayla Itzinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
It's a really rough yet ambivalent satire of the shifts that were going on in Spanish culture at the time.
Yeah.
This is, okay, Echevarria talks about this. I'm going to keep saying that. But the cliche is that the first book of Don Quixote is the Renaissance book. The second book is the Baroque book.
Yeah.
But that was such an aspect of the Baroque was the disillusionment, the disenchantment.
Right.
To show it, you know, for the reality that it is. Don Quixote in showing, or Cervantes in showing the illusory nature of all this is really showing the reality, which is these people are nothing.
Right.
All right. So the Duke and Duchess, they take in Don Quixote and they just start messing with him. So they're out in the garden and there's another mask. Demons and devils show up again. We can't get enough of demons and devils. And finally, the figure of death arrives and claims he's Merlin in the image of death. And he says that in order to disenchant Dulcinea, Sancho has to whip himself, I think it's several thousand times.
Yeah, it's like 3,000 or 4,000 times. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And, all right, so because Sancho had basically told the Duke and Duchess, he had a private conversation with the Duchess where he told her all about, hey, I never actually saw Dulcinea. And I made this up on the road, but you can't tell Don Quixote. So they use that against him, and their whole plan is to get Sancho to hurt himself.
Right.
The joke is pain.
Yeah, that's the okay. the only gag that they have.
Yeah.
Is that they're going to get this peasant to harm himself. Yeah.
Yeah, and they keep doing it again and again. Okay, so Sancho is finally made governor of an island. The Duke says, fine, I'll give you an island. I have an insula, and I'd love for you to be the governor. So he's prepping for all of that when there's another procession. Out in the garden, we have another creepy, scary procession where the Dolorous Duenna, led by Trifaldin, comes in with the bearded ladies. Basically, this is a story within the story, or a mask within the story, where this Duenna, it's the butler in disguise with his beard showing, basically saying that he was the go-between between this virtuous woman and this other character who then became an evil giant. It's a parallel to the Miko Mikona section in the first book of Don Quixote. So in order to defeat the giant who's holding the whole lands hostage, Don Quixote must ride this magical wooden horse. He must ride it and fly through the sky and face down the giant, and Sancho must ride on the back. And so basically what it is a giant exploding pinata.
Yeah.
They hoist it up in the air, and they do all these special effects to make them think they're flying, and then at the end they blow it up.
Right, so it's just like packed full of firecrackers, and they just light that candle, yeah.
Yeah, so that's when Sancho has this vision of being high up in the air and looking down at the ground and seeing the stars and all this other stuff. And there's this really interesting moment where Don Quixote comes up to him after he says all this, and everybody knows he's faking it because they saw him on the horse, the sort of wooden horse. And Don Quixote says, "Hey, listen, if you say Montesinos was real, I say everything you experienced was real." And what that signals is this growing awareness in Don Quixote that, yeah, I know I'm faking it. I know this isn't for real. I know this is just me horsing around. But this is way better than reality. So it's just this weird aside, but it plays in thematically with the rest of the book.
Yeah.
Okay. So Sancho is going to go to this supposed island. It's just this town that I suppose is under the Duke's governance. And the butler's going to take him there, and they're going to set him up with this governorship. The night before he leaves, Don Quixote gives him basically two chapters of political wisdom, which is actually sage political wisdom. All right. So in the meantime, Don Quixote, they have this weird split where it's like a chapter of Sancho, a chapter of Don Quixote. They're sort of on their own for this bit. Don Quixote is fending off the affection of Altisidora, this girl who has, quote unquote, fallen in love with him.
Yeah.
She's singing him all these, heartbreaking songs in the middle of the night. And he doesn't know what to do with this because his chivalric code says he must reject all of this. Okay, so Sancho gets to the island and starts judging a whole bunch of court cases, essentially. And they're court cases that are taken from kind of folk legend and all kinds of other, previously written narrative tales. But they basically prove that Sancho's not an idiot. He's actually doing very well, and everyone is surprised at how smart he is, because he right. really is pretty smart.
Yeah.
Okay, so Don Quixote stays up all night waiting for Altisidora to show up in the courtyard, and he sings this song about the virtues of not giving in to lust and being a decent person. And that's when Altisidora, her, I guess, partners in crime, which I suppose include the Duke and Duchess to a degree, throw a bunch of, basically throw a sack of cats on Don Quixote, and he gets all scratched up and messed up.
Right.
I say this as my own cat is trying to scratch something. Okay. So anyway.
It's, hey man, it's cats. That's what they're going to do. God bless them. Every one of them.
So anyway, so Don Quixote gets all scratched up and sent to bed. So Sancho, the next day, is not allowed to eat. This is another one of the so-called pranks. And the Duke and Duchess basically have this doctor who they said, you know, offer him all the tantalizing food in the world and then don't let him eat any of it. And so Sancho is being starved. Yeah. Haha. All right. So then Don Quixote has this late night talk with one of the duennas in the Duchess's household. A duenna was sort of like an old widowed lady who served sort of, I guess, courtly functions around the house.
Yeah.
And she tells this story. Essentially, her daughter had basically been loved and left by this rich man's son. The rich man is the farmer who's loaning all the money to the Duke and Duchess.
Yeah.
And the son basically did the same thing that Don Fernando did to Dorotea back in book one. We're married in the eyes of God. Let's go ahead and have sex. She said, sure, that's right up my alley. She believed him, and he basically left her pregnant and split. Because the farmer is loaning all this money to the Duke and Duchess and doesn't think it's a good match,
yeah.
The Duke and Duchess aren't interested in doing anything about it. Then Altisidora and all her friends get mad at this, blow out the candle that the duenna is holding, and then beat up Don Quixote and the duenna.
Right.
So, in the night, Don Quixote just believes it's a bunch of demons. So, enchanters will do what they do. All right. So, back to Sancho. Sancho goes on patrol around the island. And again, he keeps meeting people in the dark, and he's put into this position of trying to judge whether or not they're a threat, and he judges very wisely. Everyone's amazed. Okay, we go back to Don Quixote, and in the middle of the day, the duenna brings her daughter and says, basically, will you please help us? You're the writer of wrongs. And Don Quixote says, yes, of course. I will find this guy who left you. And the Duke and Duchess are not very pleased by this, if you read between the lines, but figure out a way to turn it to one more prank. Basically, they're going to have one of their lackeys dress up as a knight and joust with Don Quixote and just knock him off his horse and knock him around a little bit and get out of this whole thing. Okay, so in the meantime, everybody realizes that Sancho is actually a pretty good governor, but they're like, well, we can't have this peasant, you know, being our governor, so we got to get rid of him. So they pretend that the butler and his cronies pretend that the island is under attack and dress Sancho up in this armor that's so heavy he just falls down. So they run over him and jump on top of him, stomp him for a while until they open him up and tell him, okay, we won. We won the day. Everything's all clear. Sancho takes off the armor, goes to the hostelry, gets his donkey, and rides the hell off. He's had enough. So they got rid of the best governor they ever had or could have, and that's the end. Yeah. All right. So Sancho is on his way back, and he runs into this guy, Ricote, who's a Morisco from La Mancha that Sancho knew. They're friends. But because of the expulsion of the Moriscos,
yeah.
Ricote had to split. His daughter, who, you know, was full-on Christian, became a Catholic, was forced to flee to Morocco with his wife. They were the really strong Catholics. Ricote is kind of on the fence about the whole thing. But he went to Germany to try to see if that would be a safe haven. And now he's coming back to get some of the gold that he buried in Spain, go to Morocco, get his daughter and mother, daughter and wife, and take them to safe haven in Germany.
Yeah.
Sancho won't turn him in, and he's not going to help him, but he's sort of like, you know, I hope everything turns out for the best. It's this really ambivalent moment because Cervantes doesn't want to come right out and say, hey, man, this is messed up.
Right, right.
But it does signal this kind of empathy towards people who have been branded enemy of the state,
yeah,
and are being kicked out pretty unrighteously.
And this would have, I think it's interesting to note that this aggressive expulsion took place This was taking place actually sort of between, it really picked up after the publication of book one. So this is kind of, this was something that was going on as Cervantes was writing this second part. Like this was happening. There were whole towns being depopulated. I mean, you're talking about like, this was literally ethnically cleansing between 5 to 10% of the population of some areas. I mean, of Iberian Peninsula in total, and closer to like 40 to 50% in some parts of it. I mean, it's just an enormous undertaking of dispossession.
Yeah, and it ruined the economy.
Yeah, it destroyed the economy, especially in the in kind of the eastern part of sort of more the Mediterranean coast, which was also kind of the last holdouts in Granada and Valencia. Those kind of the last holdouts of the Iberian Moorish states over there. It just wrecked them because you had like, these are the people who actually worked the land. These were the people who are actually doing productive work. These were the workers who made all the stuff that all the lords would then take. So
it's sort of like the coming food crisis in America because of the neo-Nazis, Nazis, white supremacists, whatever polite term you want to have. I have no polite terms, who currently occupy the Department of Homeland Security.
Exactly. So. Exactly. Yeah. Expelling these people who and spend their lives laboring to feed us. Yeah, that's a really good plan. Anyway, okay. Yeah. We're getting upset, everybody.
Yeah. I'm not getting there. I'm already there.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
So Sancho leaves Ricote and then falls in a hole. Okay. So he falls into a pit and he doesn't know what he's doing. And so he's in this cave and he and his donkey are trying to find the way out. Don Quixote, meanwhile, is about to joust with the lackey disguised as the farmer's son. He's getting all pumped up for that. And that's when he hears Sancho. And the cave comes out the other end of where the Duke and Duchesses were. So he falls into this hole near the side of the road, walks it all night, and ends up back at the Duke and Duchesses. So it's – I'm going to talk about this in a little bit, but there are all these parallels to the underworld. Mm-hmm. The whole novel in many ways is very concerned with the descent to the underworld. Don Quixote's Cave of Montesinos is – really modeled on Homer, Virgil, and Dante.
Yeah, yeah.
And, Sancho's falling into a hole is kind of like a parodic version of it. So anyway, Don Quixote finds him, and he goes to joust this lackey, and then the lackey falls in love with the girl because he's like, oh, man, she's beautiful. So he takes off his helmet and basically proposes, says, hey, man, can't be with the one you love. Love the one you're with. Yeah. She says, okay, that's good enough for me. And the Duke and Duchess are really mad because he ruined the fun. They don't get to watch Don Quixote joust, and they really don't care about this girl. And so they're like, yeah, we'll consider the marriage. Let's confine the lackey for a few days to see if he really wants it. So they basically lock him up in jail. It's not treated in the text as if it's a horrible thing. You have to look at the actual event because the tone of the reporting is no different than the tone of the rest of the reporting, mm-hmm. like the narration. But this is clearly these guys basically thwarted the love plot of book one.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the Duke and Duchess do, and they just don't care.
Yeah.
All right. So Don Quixote figures, well, I served my role and I'm doing good. So I'm going to go get back on the road and head out to Saragossa. They meet a couple of, artisans who are carrying these icons and relics. And they're relics depicting chivalric and saintly stories. Mm-hmm. And surprisingly to Sancho, Don Quixote does not think that they're real. He knows what they are. Again, this is Don Quixote sort of becoming unillusioned.
Right.
Disillusioned, in a sense. Okay, so... sorry, my cat is doing something. So anyway, they go to an inn, and Don Quixote does not mistake it for a castle.
Yeah.
And they overhear someone talking about the second book of Don Quixote. Now, they know about the first book of Don Quixote, but they're like, how can there be a second book of Don Quixote? We haven't done anything yet. Yeah. And he talks to this guy who says, yeah, yeah, in the second book of Don Quixote goes to Saragossa and he has all these stupid adventures, and eventually he's locked up and all this other stuff. And Don Quixote says, but I am Don Quixote. Well, if that guy goes to Saragossa to participate in the jousts, screw that. I'm going to Barcelona. That's where he's kidnapped by bandits. He's taken prisoner by bandits on the road, and that's when he meets Roque Guinart, who is a Catalan bandit, and he was a real guy. He's this weird parallel. I'll talk about the parallels in a minute. In the second book, everyone is a mirror image in some way of Don Quixote, mm-hmm. but Don Quixote is also a mirror image of everyone else. So it's like mirrors within mirrors.
Yeah.
But he kind of gets along with Roque Guinart because Guinart, even though he's a bandit, he's a robber, he has this kind of code of honor which skews towards the chivalric code. So they kind of meet each other as equals in this interesting way. In the middle of this, you have the story of Claudia Jeronimo, who's another bandit's daughter who fell in love with this other man, who fell in love with this man, who she heard was cheating on her, so she went and shot him. And they go to see what's going on, like what happened, how is this guy going to die? And he dies.
Yeah.
Now, this is a parallel to Basilio and Quiteria, where you had what looked like death coming back to life, but in this case, the death is final, it's for real. So it's this weird side story embedded in the Roque Guinart passage. All right. So Don Quixote is given safe passage, basically, to Barcelona. And when he gets there, they're having a party. It's St. George's feast, and it's basically the whole town is a carnival.
Yeah.
And we get yet another mask.
Right.
So it's like the whole point is that the whole second book is very theatrical and keeps advertising its theatricality.
Right.
So it's sort of like this theater and this theater and this theater and this theater. So it's this kind of large-scale carnival celebration. Everyone is already in disguise. So when Don Quixote, the famous character from this book, shows up for real, well, it's just one more disguise. It's right. Sort of like his disguise is his reality, you know? So he's taken in by a couple of the, essentially, what are the nouveau riche. And they have a little bit of fun with him. And that's where you get the episode of the head. This guy claims to have a head that can tell you anything you want to know. It's this, I guess, metal head sitting in a room. And what it is a head hooked up to a tube that goes down to the basement where someone down in the basement can hear it and speak back.
Yeah.
Can hear whatever's spoken in the room and can speak back. And so he's got his nephew, who's a witty student, basically down there giving answers to anything and everything. And so they charm Don Quixote. He dances until he gets sick. And then they go to a bookshop, and Don Quixote actually reads the fake second book of Don Quixote and says, this is garbage. they go out to see the boats. They basically get to the ocean. And it's interesting that the second book of Don Quixote is kind of, Echeverria makes this point, I'm going to keep saying it, it's about the journey to the sea.
Mm-hmm.
They hit the very ends of Spain in a way.
Well, that's kind of what struck me is that he's Don Quixote is from Extremadura, and the whole first book basically takes place around his neighborhood. You know, yeah. He's there in Extremadura. He's there, which is kind of, that's kind of like, what's the part of Spain that's like borders on Portugal. So it's kind of in the middle of the country over more toward the Atlantic side than the Mediterranean side. But this, he's actually going on a quest. He's actually going somewhere and he's going up into what was then the Kingdom of Aragon. So Zaragoza and Barcelona and all those places. Like, so it would have been, he was actually going outside of the people would have been speaking differently. you know, by this point. This would have been, you know, he's actually going somewhere, which is, you know, which is itself a big change of pace.
The first book, he never left Manhattan.
Yeah, exactly.
Second book, he makes it to what, Arkansas? Anyway.
Yeah.
But he goes to the sea, and Echeverria reads this as an encounter with death. It's the sea, and it's not just him. Symbolically, I mean, this is a running theme in a lot of literature. It's kind of like this trope. You can't master the sea. The sea is the end. It's you can't control it. You can't put force over on it. You can read it in Whitman. You can read it in Wallace Stevens, The Comedian as the Letter C, which is about this failed poet's attempt to try to compress the ocean into a knowable frame. Mm-hmm. It's oblivion in a way. It's the vastness that's beyond the human experience. And so Don Quixote reaches that. Now, when he reaches it, they go on a boat to tour it, and then the boat is attacked by Moorish invaders. So a small Turkish ship goes in, they exchange gunfire, and they capture the Turkish ship. And lo and behold, the captain is a woman in disguise. She is Anna Felix, Ricote's daughter, who had been in Morocco. Her boyfriend, who's a rich Catholic, followed her, and they had to disguise him as a woman so he would be less appealing to the Turkish court, which is kind of a jab at Turkish sexual mores. Mm-hmm. Okay, so or perceived Turkish sexual mores. So she was in league with a secret Catholic among the raiders, and their plan was to ditch the boat, get to shore, turn everybody in, and then raise money to go back and get her boyfriend out. Lo and behold, again, Ricote is in Barcelona.
Yeah.
And he sees her and meets her, and they meet up with a viceroy who's like, oh my God, this is such a heartbreaking story. Tell you what, I'll get together an envoy. We'll go and get this guy out of Morocco. You seem like good people. And once we've gotten him out of Morocco, I'm going to go to the court and petition on your behalf so that you can stay here. Now, there's no ending to the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of what he's doing, as you pointed out, this was contemporary events. Mm-hmm. The ending hasn't been written. It seems hopeful, but we just don't know how it's going to play out.
Yeah.
And I think Cervantes is pointing us in a hopeful direction, but that's not how it went.
Yeah.
That's really not how it went. In fact, the guy that they're going to go petition was one of the worst, most xenophobic, ethnophobic, whatever bastards that you could. There. And so, yeah, it probably didn't work, but it's left open-ended. Okay. By the sea, Don Quixote is challenged by the Knight of the White Moon. He's white on white. This is a point that Echeverria makes. He's white on white. He's blankness. He is oblivion. He is death. In the challenge with the Knight of the Knight of the Mirrors, Don Quixote is sort of facing himself, and he's also facing his own lunacy. In the Knight of the White Moon, he's basically facing death, and he loses.
Yeah.
Now, who is the Knight of the White Moon who shows up and challenges him to combat? It's Sansón Carrasco.
Time to try this plan again. Yeah.
Yeah, but this time he doesn't stall, and he just charges right at Don Quixote, knocks him off the horse, and tells him, you have to go back to La Mancha and not engage in acts of chivalry for 1 year.
Yeah.
So Don Quixote says, okay, I'll do it. He and Sancho start heading back. They have to return to La Mancha, and they have all these adventures on the way back. They meet Tassilius, who is the lackey of the Duke and Duchess, who basically tells them he wasn't allowed to marry the girl, and she's sort of still pregnant back in their castle. They decides to adopt a pastoral life for a little while. It's like Don Quixote is trading in his chivalric identity for a pastoral identity. So he's trading one genre for another. And that's when they're stomped by stampeding pigs and then kidnapped by the Duke and Duchess's men. They're dragged back to the Duke and Duchess's castle, where there's this giant display where everybody looks dead. And then yet another mask with Altisidora as Dido on a pyre. And all of these sort of demonic characters tell everyone that all the duennas in the castle have to slap Sancho and poke him in the butt with needles in order to revive her. And they get up to a point when Sancho grabs a torch and starts swinging it at people and says, "Anybody touches me next, you're going down."
Right.
So it's sort of like he finally fights back.
Yeah.
And that's when Altisidora wakes up and says, you know, she basically spits out a bunch of curses at Don Quixote. "You horrible, awful, chivalric fool." Later on that night, she comes to his room and she's basically having this confrontation with him, and they start picking her brain and they're like, "Well, did you go to hell when you were dead on the pyre? Did you go to hell?" And she says, "Well, maybe it wasn't hell, but, you know, I did see a bunch of devils playing tennis with the heads of souls, and then they ran out of heads and they started playing tennis with books, and there were flaming books on fire. And the one that she noticed was the fake Book 2 of Don Quixote."
And obviously, if any book was going to be condemned to hell, it would be that.
Yes. Yeah. So they go to an inn that Don Quixote again doesn't mistake as a castle. And they meet an actual character from the fake book, the fake second book of Don Quixote. So it's this character who is kind of one of the main characters of the fake second book. And he says, "Well, wait a minute, you're not Don Quixote. I was just hanging with Don Quixote." And Don Quixote says, "No, I'm the real Don Quixote." And he talks to Sancho and they have this whole thing where eventually they convince the guy and they get him to swear an affidavit and get it signed by a notary that the fake Don Quixote that appears in the second book of Don Quixote is not the real Don Quixote. This is the real Don Quixote. So you have a fake character meeting a second fake character swearing on their reality.
Yes.
Okay. So they eventually get back to La Mancha, and Don Quixote sees a whole bunch of omens sort of that he thinks signifying that Dulcinea will never be disenchanted and he'll never see her for real. And when they get back home, Don Quixote falls ill. He's out of it for a couple of days. He comes to, he renounces chivalry, he makes a will, and he embraces his identity as Alonso Quijana, this old, old, you know, would-be gentleman. He does right by everybody. He even gives Sancho his share.
Yeah.
And then he dies. Cid Hamete hangs up his pen. The end.
Yeah.
All right, so that took up an hour.
It did, but I would say ably done, Claude.
All right,
I think that was a very able synopsis.
I had 30 minutes to make my notes today while my son was sleeping, so I, you know. But anyway, so the theoretical or thematic stuff that I think is really important is to think about this first as the Baroque book of disillusionment and disenchantment. I'm leaning on Echeverria, but I want to elaborate on this and sort of draw from it on my own a little bit. Theatricality is all over the place in Book Two of Don Quixote, but so is this idea that the quest is for disenchantment. Mm-hmm. The whole quest this time around is to disenchant Dulcinea, but how do you disenchant a figment of your imagination? You get rid of it.
Yeah.
So part of this is Don Quixote sort of waking up to the reality of his own life. But, and this is a Baroque thing, if you think about this in Baroque Catholic terms, the reality of your life is really just another dream. The real life takes place after you're dead.
Right.
So that's part of this whole play with illusions all in Don Quixote. On the one hand, it's all about disillusionment, but it's also disillusionment within certain parameters that knows the final disillusionment will be death.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that really ties in with that, what you're saying about the journey to the sea, this journey to oblivion, you know, inaccessible oblivion. Yeah. That's wow. Yeah.
So the real life begins after you're dead. And this is something that, you know, really, really struck me. I do think that Cervantes is sort of leaning on that a little bit. Mm-hmm. And this is what made me I keep thinking back to Montaigne. When you meditate on life and when you do all this thinking and revising and rethinking and working through all of it, it helps you to understand the illusions and it helps you to die. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of stoicism, you know, that I think we talked about in Montaigne. And I think that there's a similar stoicism in Cervantes. Having said that, you know, it does seem to me thematically that he is working towards this idea that the real disenchantment, to be unenchanted, is to die.
Yeah.
And there's something about Cervantes that wants to adopt a kind of philosophical or stoic stance towards that. I don't find this to be Christian at all.
Hmm.
I don't know what it is, but there, it doesn't strike me that this is really that Catholic a work. This seems something else.
Yeah, I think you're really onto something. And this ties in a little bit to some thoughts I had while I was reading the second book. And this is going to be a bit pat. It's going to be a bit glib because I'm a pat and glib man. Everyone who's listened to the show knows this about me, so this is not a surprise to anybody. But here's kind of here's something that's been rolling around in my brain. I'm going to discover it as I talk about it, right? But sort of, it's tying into that. It's not Catholic. Like it's, you know, and I think you're right. Like I think it's book two. Having read book two, I began to sort of interpret book one as a loving parody of Castile itself. Castile mm-hmm. as a state project, Castile as a society. Because I sort of started seeing it as like, well, you know, Don Quixote is he is of the kind of privileged class and yet not really all that privileged, which makes him kind of a kind of stand-in for either end of the societal scale. He's an everyman in that sense. And what is he doing? He is haunted by visions of glory. He is haunted by this compulsion to holy endeavor. And he rides out and attempts to find monsters to slay wherever he might, but instead all he finds is normal people going about their lives, and he makes a mess of everything while trying to embody this grand destiny. What was Spain doing? You know, you had Spain was going around the world, you know, looking for crusades to fight, and you know, and they'd be justified for all the you know, violence they inflicted on these people all around the world who weren't monsters, who weren't dragons. There's people living their lives, and the Spaniards show up and you destroy everything and take all their stuff and enslave them. And for what? And even that is futile, because all of this, like, you read about, like, the Spanish Empire, the amount of sheer human life that was spent dragging precious metal out of the ground halfway across the world to send it back over to Europe to pay people to go kill other people in the Habsburg holdings on the rest of the European continent for nothing. For nothing. Because they would just utterly lay waste to, I'm thinking specifically of what's called the 80 Years' War. Let that rattle around in your brain for a minute. The 80 Years' War, which was basically the struggle for independence in the Dutch-speaking portions of the Habsburg holdings in what is today Belgium and the Netherlands. And that's what all this – that's so even though you had this world-spanning empire – This kind of imperial endeavor that had never been seen before, Spain itself still remained in many ways this backward place, this impoverished place, this continually impoverishing place, as it expelled productive people out of it, all in the pursuit of this, I'm going to use the word, quixotic goal of of this kind of this idea of dominion. And as I read book two, I, in this sort of the schema that I've built for myself, where Don Quixote represents, you know, the Castilian political project in the first one, book two, it's almost Cervantes apologizing to Don Quixote for that.
Yeah.
It's him, you know, Don Quixote goes out and he sees what is the real face of this monster. What is the real face of this monster? It's the aristocracy. What is the real face of this monster? It's ethnic cleansing. What is the real face of all of this? It's the just bland cruelty inflicted by the powerful against the less powerful. And who has wisdom in book two? Sancho Panza. Who can actually, who has enough experience with the way things actually work in the concrete world where people work together to get things done to actually make just judgments? It's not someone who spent their lives in an ivory tower. It's not someone who spent their lives being taught, you know, going through, you know, arguments about how many angels dance on the head of a pin, and then they're handed the reins to, like, you know, these huge mannered estates or whatever. It's Sancho Panza. And
well, then,
yeah, so that's my own probably very dumb interpretation.
You're absolutely right because that's one of the things that keeps coming up are questions of authors and authority.
Yeah.
There's a lot of anti-clerical stuff in book two, and there's also a lot of weird anti-book stuff. Now, it's mostly directed at the fake second book of Don Quixote, but there's also this weird thing about how books are great and all, but really the best authority is experience. Yeah. And that's Sancho. And again, that seems to be the through line. If we go, okay, let's ignore Dante for a little bit, but if we go back to Canterbury Tales, if we go to Montaigne, if we go right into Don Quixote, and even into Molière to a degree, the through line is books are great, trust experience, trust your gut.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just, I think you're absolutely right that Sancho is the one who's he seems to be the only capable one of doing anything. And he is capable because he's not deluded by the, I guess, the courtly education or by aristocratic I'm trying to think about this. He would love to be an aristocrat. He would love to be a governor.
He would love
to rise above his station, but he's also, like, there's no possible way he's going to do it. But when given the chance, he does it.
Right. If I'm going to go way out on a limb here, and I will say Sancho Panza is the official literary embodiment of the noble experiment in worker self-management that was the Catalonian anarchist commune during the Spanish Civil War. I have probably offended politically and historically a lot of people by saying this, but long live Catalonia. Sancho Panza, you know, you're doing great, sweetie. I love you.
So yeah, no, I think you're right about that, and the position of Spain, the basically collapse of the empire, not even collapse, it held itself up as being still very much alive, but everybody could see through it, and there had been, you know, a generation or so of extraordinarily bad aristocratic management that the Baroque is often commenting upon. Mm-hmm. All right, so you have disillusionment and disenchantment. You have mirrors. Okay, I said this before. Everything is a reflection of Don Quixote. So the gentleman in green is Alonso Quijano. Like, what he could have been, i.e., just a decent country gentleman who ran everything adequately, who was appropriate, who married, settled down, kept within his bounds, and just kept order in the lands that he had inherited, you know? Sansón Carrasco is another version of Don Quixote. is he not just as crazy? Like, your plan to return this guy to sanity is to inspire him to be insane so that you can beat him up to return.
Well, it's like, you know, the only way to defeat the insanity is to defeat the insanity in its own game. You're right. Well, like, the plan is that he'll go and, like, he'll defeat him as a knight, and that means that, you know, Don Quixote has been bested, so he has to do what he says, you know.
And, you know, so in, and even other characters, you know, the Duke and Duchess are crazier than Don Quixote is. I mean, they're, if Don Quixote is a nobleman who's basically wasting his life and what resources he has on this stupid quest, they're going even further, wasting all of their time and resources just to entertain themselves with this guy who they're misreading. So on and so forth. Everyone is a kind of parallel to Don Quixote.
Mm-hmm.
But Don Quixote also reveals them through his conversation with them.
Yeah.
So it's mirrors within mirrors in this strange way. Now, another thing that happens is, okay, Echevarria points this out. God, I'm tired of saying that. But book two mirrors sections of book one, but then book two begins to mirror itself, right?
Yeah.
So you've got, I mean, the woman who kills her lover is a parallel or a mirror image of the Basilio pretending to kill himself. What that begins to be is the situation where events are sequential and not necessarily heavily plotted.
Mm-hmm.
A plot is a causal connection between the events, and a sequential plot is going to be one where it just goes from event to event to event to event to event. Like, there are events in a sequence, not necessarily in some kind of direct causal connection. So, like, if you look back at book one, the framework of the whole is sort of Don Quixote and Sancho going out there, but then they get drawn into this love plot, and the love plot, the tales, begin to sort of dictate the movement of the story, so that eventually they coincide and all become one. So it becomes this sort of narrative drive. There's less narrative drive and more of sort of sequential event in book two, because everything is a mirror of everything else. That signals that it's sort of variations and permutations on a theme. And, okay, on the one hand, that's picked up in the 20th century and becomes a sort of aspect of postmodern writing, because it sort of liberates everything from the direct causal connection of plot, right?
Yeah.
But it also signals this weird way in which you could really consider Don Quixote as a Baroque work. And I'm thinking Baroque, like, in terms of a Bach fugue. Like, the Art of the Fugue is nothing but sequential variation and permutation of counterpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the only thing that stopped Bach from continuing the Art of the Fugue was, well, he died.
Right.
I mean, he could have just kept going. I mean, it's a great work. It's a phenomenally bizarre work. But, yeah, that's sort of how Don Quixote Book 2 plays out, is everything is just a variation and permutation of everything else. So even though they're moving somewhere geographically, thematically, they're just spinning in circles. It's like a giant fugue. Mm-hmm. It ends when Don Quixote dies. So that weird sequencing is something that I find really fascinating. So then after that, you have this issue of authors and authority.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, everybody keeps trying to author everybody else. And we saw this a little bit in book one, where characters seemed to be self-authoring.
Right.
Like, they would, you know, Don Quixote famously read books of chivalry and rewrote himself as a knight. The rich girl rewrote herself as a shepherdess because she wanted to live out in the woods. Mm-hmm. The guy who was way into her rewrote himself through his funeral orations in a particular right. light. So everybody's sort of revising themselves and remaking themselves. We talked about that. In book two, other characters are trying to author Don Quixote.
Yeah.
So Sansón Carrasco thinks he can write the story to contain Don Quixote, and he can't.
He loses because
Don Quixote knocks him off the horse.
Yeah.
The butler is trying to write the story for the governorship of Sancho's Island, but Sancho keeps getting away from him because Sancho's too smart. Yeah, I mean, he never sees through it, but his governorship is actually very good. So there's this issue of authors and authority. Who is really in charge? And ultimately, as we were just sort of talking about, experience is the best choice, right?
Yeah.
Everything keeps getting thrown off. And I think that leads to the running joke of, you know, someone else tried to author Don Quixote. And Cervantes took that apocryphal book and just throttled it within an inch of its life.
Yeah.
So he kind of outdid it. So then you have the classical allusions. One of the things that's going on in the first book is that, you know, clearly Cervantes is drawing from the chivalric tales, and that's sort of like the primary source. But he steps up the game in the second book by turning everything to Virgil, Homer, and Dante. And you can see this most clearly in all of the underworld stuff. The whole book, in a lot of ways, is about going into the dark, mm-hmm. the descent into the dark. It starts in the very beginning when they get to Toboso. They arrive there in the dark. It's a kind of city of the dead. And they butt right up against the church, and presumably they're in the graveyard.
Yeah.
The whole thing is a descent, and characters keep descending to the underworld. Now, what he does with that is allows the imagination to run rampant. And what you get when Don Quixote descends into the cave of Montesinos is basically Don Quixote's inner life. Echevarria reads this as out-Freuding Freud, because there's yeah. so much of the uncanny that Freud sort of had to catch up with. And Freud was a reader of Don Quixote, sort of famously. But the cave of Montesinos is Don Quixote revealing his unconscious, the depth of who he is. Mm-hmm. Echevarria reads that as his growing awareness that what he's doing is a form of madness. And he sees that as the point at which he begins to regain his sanity, because he begins to see that this is all an illusion, an enchantment, and it doesn't make any sense. But I'm not quite sure if I agree with him on that.
Mm-hmm.
Echevarria reads the whole book as, or all of book two, as Don Quixote's quest essentially to overthrow himself so that he can regain his sanity. I think that's a little too pat. I think that's going a little too far, but mm-hmm. it is something that I can see lurking back there. I think it's too much to say that it gives it the structure of the whole, but it is another thematic thing that's lurking back there. But anyway, you have yeah. Sancho falling in the pit. You have Altisidora's dream. These are all descents into the underworld and the unconscious or the subconscious of all of these characters. So anyway, that's what I came up with.
Yeah. I mean, that's marvelous. I mean, you're absolutely right. It's, man, as I mean, just as with the first book, like I come away from reading Don Quixote just incredibly impressed with, I don't know if I'm going to express this correctly, how much that Cervantes had to hold inside his head while he wrote.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like to make it all work. And even then, like, it's a little, you know, it's a little ramshackle, but it points it out. You know, it's like, oh yeah, you know, sure, Sancho Panza's wife has several different names. Yeah, let's make a joke about that. But at the same time, like, there's so many moving parts. There's so many yeah. moving parts to it, and I think it's part of what is fascinating about great writing, is that it's necessarily Well, it's necessarily a kind of sequential process as you literally write the language out, because that's how we have constructed our written word. That's how we have constructed our languages themselves. And, you know, because you can only speak one phoneme at a time, can't you?
Right.
I guess this, if you, unless you're doing like Tuvan throat singing and you can do two tones at the same time, which is, again, another marvelous human achievement. But so necessarily, if you are going to be, you know, writing is necessarily a linear act, but the whole work can have these structures, these themes, this, all this which is included in it, which the author must necessarily kind of, you know, hold in mind as they write. I mean, I'm sure, you know, using notes and all that stuff, but you know what I mean? Like, there's got to be a, there's the, I don't know. I'm just, I find myself being very impressed with how much Cervantes, the conception that he had, and how it was expressed so elegantly and hilariously on the page, just considering how it was transmitted from whatever conception he had onto the page in the form of this language.
The way we're talking about it, we're making this sound okay. We're making this sound like a very, very heady, intense, you know.
Yeah, like it's some sort of like work that, like that's, dense that's, and whatever, but it's a breeze to read.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing that I find really amazing about this work.
Yeah.
Is that okay? One of the points that Echevarria makes, and I wanted to get back to this. I wanted to say that phrase again. Yeah, everybody is misreading the first book of Don Quixote. Like they're basically reading it like I thought I was supposed to read it back when I was 17, reading this on my parents' couch, you know, because I had a book report to do on it.
Yeah,
it's not the story of some stupid idiot that we're supposed to make fun of.
Yeah,
it was never that in the first place. There's more to it than that, and everybody who has read the first book keeps thinking, well, here's the dumb madman, or here's the lunatic who's going to do something stupid, and his fat gluttonous idiot sidekick.
Right.
And the Duke and Duchess definitely read it that way, and that's not who they are.
Yeah.
The other characters keep anticipating that they'll be that. Sansón Carrasco keeps anticipating that they'll be that, and they're not. They get the better of him. The author of the fake second book of Don Quixote misread it.
Yeah.
And I think that was like a real gall to Cervantes, because apparently in the fake book, Don Quixote is eventually cured by, you know, spending time in a lunatic asylum. He's a figure of much ridicule. People beat him up and everybody laughs at him in that same sort of power way that the canon was laughing at him.
Yeah.
That we pointed out last time. And Sancho is just a drunk and a glutton.
Yeah.
And he's definitely looking for food, but Cervantes keeps making the point he's looking for food because they're out in the road starving.
Right. You'd be looking for food too, man. Yeah.
So, but anyway, yeah, that nobody seems to have read the first book accurately. And so they're imposing a meaning on it, but Don Quixote keeps slipping away from them.
Mm-hmm.
He's more than what everyone anticipates he's going to be. And he can always find some way to maneuver out from under it. That's the thing that I think that gives some credence to Echevarria's claim that this is about him trying to conquer himself in some way, to disenchant himself. There's something to that, because ultimately he's going to prove saner than everyone else around him. But I still think that's a little too pat. But I think that's really sort of it, is that this is a heavy work, and it's a heady work, but it's such a funny work, and it's such a breeze to read. Maybe if we're still alive, we'll get to Ulysses one of these days, which is also a very funny work and a very heady work.
Mm-hmm.
The Ulysses is very, very rich, and I really like the book, but it's not an easy read. This is. I mean, it's extraordinarily light. It's you can go into it misreading. You can go into it thinking you're going to get one thing and then suddenly realizing you're reading something else. But you can also go into it for fun.
Yeah.
I mean, this... I think I talked about this with Ludovici, that this is a very fast book.
Mm-hmm.
You're done with it, like, maybe in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And there's something about the speed and just the joy of reading it that I think makes you overlook what Cervantes is really getting at here.
Yeah.
And I think this illusory nature of the world is sort of at the heart of it all. Don Quixote gets the chance to invent and reinvent, and then he gets the chance to see through himself. Everything else after book one is sort of everyone else's corrupt invention.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets to hang on to his chivalric ideal by renouncing his chivalric ideal and having the heroism to see through that, you know?
Yeah.
Man, I hate the Duke and Duchess.
Yeah, it's a phenomenally very well painted, just the people you love to hate, you know, and just and again, in a fine skewering of the aristocratic class as a whole, I think. And I think that was part of what Cervantes was setting out to do, especially because like they're consumed with cruelty, but they can't even do that themselves. They have to get their butler to do it.
Yeah, they need another author. Like, how many processions can we have in one house?
Yeah.
I mean, how much time do you have? But yeah, it's a really phenomenal work. And I feel like, what did we just spend, you know, nearly 2 hours talking about this? I feel we've just gotten to the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely one of those works. And I know we say this every time, but I heartily recommend to all the listeners out there to please read it for yourself. You can read these things for yourself and see how dunderheaded, you know, I or Claude might have been about something, and you can write us and tell us about it.
Yeah, please do. I feel like we've just gotten to the tip of the iceberg, that there's so much more here. It's such a rich work, and there's so much more to think about in terms of how all of this is reflecting back on itself. It's just as elaborate and, I guess, constructed in a way to question reality as, well, I'll go back to Memento or Inception, mm-hmm. like a Nolan film.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not, it doesn't have the portentousness at all,
Yeah.
It's just a breeze to sort of move through, and what a beautiful work. You know, a similar work or a work in a similar vein would be Calderon's Life is But a Dream,
mm-hmm.
about the prince who, you know, he grows up in a tower because everyone's scared he's going to be a horrible bastard as a king. He's liberated from the tower and told, hey, you're actually a king. He wakes up on the throne and then becomes a horrible bastard. So then they're like, all right, we can't have this. And they knock him out and put him back to sleep and put him back in the tower. And he's like, well, what happened to the kingdom? He said, that was a dream. Oh, okay. And then he's liberated again and put on the throne again. And this time he realizes, well, either I'm in the tower or I'm the king right now, and I can't trust either reality, so I might as well be a good guy, because who knows what's going to happen next.
Right. Yeah.
There's a similar kind of play with that in this. But like I said, I can't quite put my finger on what exactly Cervantes' theology is. I mean, in life, pragmatically, he was a Catholic. He mm-hmm. took last rites and what have you. But there's something about Don Quixote that, in its acceptance of death, it doesn't seem concerned with the trappings of Catholicism or Christianity.
Yeah.
And this is, I guess, my last thought about this. You know, Montaigne kept sort of writing that To study philosophy is to study how to die.
Yeah.
It's how not to fear, how not to feel anxiety, how to sort of understand the nature of pain and just accept that you are a terminal being. Don Quixote, I think, in some ways is similar to that, in that, you know, by the end, it's about Don Quixote coming to terms and accepting who he is, what he is, and a final reality, which is beyond this. But it's also a book about how to live.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you don't have your illusions, what do you have? I wake up every morning and I delude myself into believing that this soul-crushing job that I have is for the good. Mm-hmm. And I make very little money. please. Do we have a Patreon?
We don't, anyway. But that's why we might set one up for just these times. Yeah.
For very little money, I put in a lot of effort to teach people to try to write and think. And maybe one person in any given semester takes away one thing from that. I delude myself every time we come on here into believing that we are doing something worth doing, that we are reading this stuff and having this conversation and in some way, shape, or form reaching somebody to do something. And yet I know all of this is false. In the long scheme of things, what I have done with my life is probably just a horrible wash. I have wasted my time reading all of this material, and I can't really account for having spent all that money and time learning to do this, because the recompense is only ever going to be internal, if that. And yet I wake up every morning believing that this is important.
Yeah.
I have to have that illusion in order to live.
Right, right. That's actually it's funny you mention that, because that's maybe this is a window into sort of my upbringing, but that was an element of fatherly advice that my dad told me about one time, that like but you have to have this baseline assumption that there's going to be a tomorrow and you're going to have to prepare for it. And, you know, you have to keep, you know, you have to assume that it's all going to keep going and that it's worth doing, because, you know, otherwise without that assumption, you don't really have anything else. But I think you're right that there's a kind of there's disillusionment that can result in inertia, and there is disillusionment that is liberatory.
And I think Don Quixote is going for the liberatory.
Precisely. Exactly. Like it's the difference between, I think, one of my favorite memes I've ever seen of all time. And I apologize for being the kind of guy who describes a meme to you, listeners. But there's it's two panels. And on the left side panel, it's like a black and white photo of a person sort of, you know, hangdog sitting on their bed. And it says, "Nothing in life matters." And on the other panel, it's a brightly colored, you know, fun looking dude giving the thumbs up with sunglasses and this loud Hawaiian shirt, you know, like a shark, you know, flying through the background, or, you know, dolphins or something. And it says, "Nothing in life matters." And and that's the choice, you know. And yeah. I think you're right that Cervantes was getting toward that Montanian existentialism, if we want to call it.
But there's also something else going on, though, which I think is the tweak. Is that, well, if nothing really matters, then why not be the best possible version of yourself according to how you think the world should be?
Exactly. I mean, and there
that's
it is.
Foolish.
Exactly. And you know what? It's good to, it might be good to be foolish. I mean, heavens. Why not? That's what I say.
I think we've sort of wrapped this up. I think that's what we can do with Don Quixote on this night. Are you ready, Daniel? We are about to make a headlong plunge into Milton.
Yeah, man. I have fond memories of Milton.
I'm so sorry.
Well, I enjoyed reading. You know, I read the Paradise Lost in college for some class or other, and I remember being interested by it. I remember thinking it was an interesting work. So we'll see if it holds up. I don't know. Maybe I've maybe the intervening years will have given me enough to know that John Milton sucks. Or maybe I will appreciate him all over again. That's the roll of the dice here on the Cannonball.
Well, I'll tell you this. teach him 5 years in a row.
It starts wearing a little thin.
I think I went through the wormhole on this one. I'm going to do some writing on the blog about this, but I'm not looking forward to it. As soon as we're done with Paradise Lost, I will consider myself a lucky man.
All right, man. Well, we won't make a big hash. We won't do a 6 month long symposium like we did with Don Quixote.
No, one and done.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, dear listeners, you can look forward to that next time.
So rate and review on iTunes. Find us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter. We're around. And read something. I don't care.
Yeah, there you go. If Don Quixote taught us anything, read something. I don't care.
All right. I think that's our last word.